The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome tonight on this rainy day here in Baltimore, Maryland. Before we launch into our show, today we'll be talking with America's greatest sociologist, William Julius Wilson, about his latest book, Just Race, Being Black and Poor in the Inner City. Later in the program, we'll be talking with the author Felicia Pride. But right now, it's time for traffic, and I want to tell you that WEA Traffic is supported by Nationwide Insurance, offering accident forgiveness at Nationwide Insurance. That's 1-877-NATIONWIDE. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and I'm glad you all can join us this hour. We are privileged to have on our show again today. We have not talked to him since his last book, is Dr. William Julius Wilson, who many regard as America's greatest sociologist. He's a professor at Harvard University, written incredible books like The Declining Significance of Race, The Truly Disadvantaged, and When Work Disappears, The New World of the Urban Poor. I think was his last time that we spoke with him was for that book. His latest book is Just Race, Being Black and Poor in the Inner City. And Dr. William Julius Wilson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. And I would like to correct the title, More Than Just Race.
More Than Just Race. I have it right in front of me and just misread it. I apologize.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Join us here at 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation, or write to us here at thesteinershow@gmail.com. Dr. Wilson, this is just an important book to come at this moment, I think. And I was taken with the whole Moynihan report that America made so much of. Of course, I'm talking about the Negro family, the Case for National Action. And there was a quote that one of your reviewers put in his review of your book. And he asked the question, who made this observation? At the heart of the deterioration of the fabric of Black America is the deterioration of the Black family. It's the fundamental weakness of Black Americans at the present time. And you replace the word black with Negro, and that comes from that time in 1965 out of that report that's become known as the Moynihan Report. But it was a prescient report, and in many ways provides some of the subtext for your book, I think.
Yes, that report was very prophetic. Moynihan talked about the breakdown of the poor black family. And he made a distinction between the poor black family and middle-class black families. He says the poor black family is really suffering. Middle-class black families are experiencing improvement. But he also talked about the factors that have contributed to the breakdown of the family, racial factors and changes in the economy and the legacy of slavery and so on.
Now, I remember as a young civil rights worker in 1965, that I, along with many other of my peers at that moment, vilified this book, vilified Senator Moynihan, Daniel Moynihan at that time. Yeah. The conservatives latched onto the book to use it to kind of attack programs that President Johnson was trying to create, even though the book helped those programs. And straighten our history out and that perspective out for us.
You know, it's really interesting that Moynihan wrote the speech that President Johnson drafted, the speech that President Johnson gave in 1965, his famous civil rights speech at Howard University. And black leaders praised that speech as a very important one to advance the cause of civil rights. And that speech was really sort of drawn from the Moynihan Report. And the reason that the report was so controversial is because the discussions of the report following its release were distorted, and people selected parts of the report and did not emphasize other parts. And so his discussion of what he calls the social pathologies in the inner city associated with the breakdown of the family were uncoupled. His discussion of that was uncoupled from his more comprehensive analysis of some of the structural forces that have created these problems.
And if there is an intellectual subtext to everything you've written in this book, it is your effort here, where all the research has been done over the years that you've been studying, is to recouple structural analysis with cultural analysis when we look at what's causing the degradation of so many African Americans who are mired in poverty.
Yeah, you see, the purpose of More Than Just Race, my book More Than Just Race, was to prompt social scientists to expand their vision on the factors that contribute to racial inequality in the United States, and thereby, you know, to re-examine the way they discuss these two important factors associated with racial inequality: social structural forces, ranging from those that are racial, such as segregation and discrimination, to those that are non-racial, such as impersonal changes in the economy, and cultural forces that emerge in settings created by discrimination and segregation. What do I mean by cultural forces? Shared outlooks, belief systems, values, skills, styles of presentation, linguistic patterns that emerge in settings created by discrimination and segregation. And what I try to do in the book is develop a framework that, as you point out, that integrates structural and cultural forces. And I must also emphasize that not only do I show how the two are inextricably linked, but I also attempt to explain why structural forces should receive far more attention than cultural forces in accounting for the social outcomes of poor African Americans, and also in framing public policies to address racial inequality.
So, and I want to get to those last two points here within the half an hour we have with you, but I do want to talk about what this book may launch, because one of the things that you think about is that the Moynihan Report itself kind of put a damper, a chill, on this kind of research for such a long time. You're kind of reopening a discussion that we've seen the public vilification of people like Bill Cosby or the discussions that has created leading up to Barack Obama's speech on race. And America maybe now is finally coming to a time where we can look at this in an honest way, in an intellectual way, and maybe come to some answers.
Yes, I think the timing of my book couldn't be better, because, you know, Barack Obama also talked about structural and cultural forces and how they are interrelated in his famous speech on race. And he pointed out that Americans must understand the structural forces that have created poverty in the inner cities and created unfortunate responses to poverty, and those are the cultural factors. So he analyzed the legacy of discrimination and segregation, and he also talked about the responses to chronic economic and racial subordination, responses that sometimes reinforce disadvantage. And so here you have the President of the United States highlighting these points, and most people now appreciate the importance of recognizing the integration of these two forces. The problem that Bill Cosby experienced is that he uncoupled, unlike Obama, he uncoupled the cultural responses from the structural forces. And that's why I think he's been sharply criticized. He didn't bring in the structural forces that are so important to understand.
Now, before I ask you questions about how the structural beget the cultural issues that we're facing in America today, because I really want to make that coupling in a minute, but I'd like you to take us back to your writing and your thinking, and even in this book, about what happened around the period of the late 60s through the early 70s that allowed such a large middle class, black middle class, to develop, and why so many in the African American community remain mired, but in a worse way than has been for generations, in poverty.
Yes. I talk in the book about the combined impact of some of these structural factors that I outlined in the book. A number of structural forces have adversely impacted inner-city black neighborhoods. And these include political actions that were explicitly racial, as well as impersonal economic of forces. And one of the combined impacts of these factors was the emergence of depopulated ghettos, especially in cities of the Midwest and Northeast, including Baltimore. Federal transportation and highway policy, along with mortgage interest tax exemptions, jointly facilitated the exodus of both industries and non-poor families from many inner-city neighborhoods, and in turn, the decline of industrial employment in the inner city brought about the end of the second great migration from the South to the North. So you no longer had poor blacks from the South moving to the North to replenish the vacancies created by those who were leaving. And you also had the out-migration of higher-income of blacks. And this led to the creation of depopulated ghettos as symbolized by or characterized by vacant lots, abandoned buildings. I think in Baltimore you may have as many as 40,000 abandoned.
At least 40,000 abandoned buildings is a huge subject here.
Right.
Huge issue.
So these developments helped to transform many poor black neighborhoods from densely packed areas of recently arrived migrants from the South to neighborhoods gradually abandoned by the working and middle classes. If someone were to sort of, who had been in the Baltimore inner cities in 1960 and been away for a long time and came back, they would be shocked by the changes that have occurred.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder, okay, so if we have the deindustrialization of urban America.
Yes.
Coupled with a rise in immigration.
Yes.
Everybody fighting, as you've been writing about, for these service jobs that are left in the inner city. That also is kind of then coupled with a social and welfare policy that kind of, as Moynihan wrote, that almost forced the disintegration of poor families. I mean, this is a perfect storm that has created, in some ways, what we see in the inner cities.
Yeah, I mean, there are just any combination of factors that you can talk about. The issues are very complex, and it's very dispiriting for me to see the sort of simplistic analysis that we can just simply talk about people lacking initiative and motivation.
So talk about what we do about that, though. I mean, if these are the factors that kind of created it, then they were these kind of mushrooming factors that you almost couldn't control unless you had a vastly different kind of set of social and economic policies in place 40 years ago, which we do not and don't have them in place today. But now we've seen 40-some years of the disintegration, almost 50 years of the disintegration of African-American families in the inner city and of the education system and of more. And this is a crisis.
Yes, it is a crisis. And I'm so pleased that we have a president who recognizes the crisis and is supporting programs to address them. For example, he's called for the creation of 20 promised neighborhoods patterned after the Harlem Children's Zone. I don't know how many of your listeners know about the Harlem Children's Zone, but this was featured. This zone was featured in a program on 60 Minutes. Jeffrey Canada, the visionary Jeffrey Canada, black leader in Harlem, created the Harlem Children's Zone, and his design was to flood a number of blocks in Harlem with educational, social, and medical services. In other words, to create a comprehensive safety net for the children in the area. And I tell you, the results of this program are just spectacular. The Harlem Children's Zone reaches about 4,000 parents and about 7,500 adults, covers about 100 blocks in Harlem. And it includes, in addition to all these services, a public charter school that differs from regular public schools in a sense that the teachers were selected on the basis of their ability to teach these students and on their dedication, not whether they got a degree from a school of education. But to cut to the chase, Here are students from some of the most disadvantaged families and neighborhoods with scores on cognitive tests, verbal scores and math scores in 2007, actually 2008, that matched the scores of kids in white upper middle class suburbia. For example, of the kids in the third grade who benefited from entering the program when they were in kindergarten, 100% scored at or above grade level in math in 2007. And 87% of the students in the eighth grade scored at or above grade level in math, even though they did not have the benefit of early exposure to the charter school. Now, to repeat, here are students from some of the most impoverished backgrounds performing as well in math as those kids in upper middle class suburbia. And they also, you know, done quite well with the verbal scores, but the results are not quite as spectacular. But this is a very, very comprehensive program, and Obama is going to replicate it in 20 cities across the country. And I think if you can demonstrate to the American people that you could create programs for people to help themselves, and if these programs work, I think American people will support them, because the Americans support the idea of a level playing field. And I can't think of a better level playing field than a Harlem Children's Zone, duplicating resources that you find in more privileged neighborhoods.
We're talking with Dr. William Julius Wilson. As many would note, I think the greatest sociologist here in the United States of America, professor at Harvard University. His latest book we're talking about this hour, this half hour, is More Than Just Race, Being Black and Poor in the Inner City. The
number I might add that Canada has raised about, his annual budget is roughly $58 million that he's raised through the support from corporate leaders.
And with that, one of the things that they're having a hard time right now in the Harlem Children's Zone, because it is all being done by, most of it's being done by private and charitable contribution. And what if that's going to work in America, you have to have a public policy that makes that the order of the day,
yeah,
rather than having to beg for money every year.
Precisely, and that's why I'm pleased that the Obama administration is going to try to replicate this program with federal dollars.
Join us here at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Dr. William Julius Wilson. Your chance to participate in a discussion that doesn't come along often. 410-319-8888. So if you take this proposal you have, and this is the Harlem Children's Zone, and you look at your Chapter 3,
mm-hmm,
which really talks about black men in general, and how they've borne the brunt of changes in the economy more than anybody else.
Yes.
Tie those things together for us.
Well, the problem is that young black men, like low-skilled men in other ethnic groups, have suffered from the decreased relative demand for low-skilled labor, including the computer revolution, which rewards skilled workers and displaces low-skilled workers, and the growing globalization of the economy, where low-skilled workers in this country are competing with low-skilled workers around the world. And black men, years ago, low-skilled black men could find fairly decent jobs in the manufacturing sector, but deindustrialization, with industries moving out to the suburbs and being relocated to cheaper labor areas overseas, have hurt black men more than any other groups. They have borne the brunt of deindustrialization because a higher percentage of black workers were displaced by deindustrialization than white workers. And so these changes create a situation where low-skilled black men have to now compete with the growing number of immigrants and the women who have entered the labor market in the low-paying service sector. And employers tend, if they have a surplus, tend to hire the immigrants and women first. Black men are chosen last for these jobs.
So
the only time that black men benefit in this economy is when we have a situation like we had in the late 1990s, where we had a tight labor market as a labor market where employers were looking for workers instead of workers looking for employers. We had very, very low unemployment rates. And this led to a sharp increase in the number of young black men who found jobs.
Dr. Wilson, we're going to open the phones here as we talk with William Julius Wilson. Latest book, More Than Just Race, Being Black and Poor in the Inner City. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Or write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. And James in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, James, we can. You're on the air.
I would like to know this program that he mentioned in Harlem, in New York. Certainly in the areas of Baltimore, especially West Baltimore, as far as what good would it really do as of right now, aiming at a lot of this gang activity that's been going on, as per se. I mean, because when I was coming up, we had a lot of recreational centers and, you know, other youth programs, you had the pool going, and
right.
And it was a lot of kids had a lot of things to do besides go hang out on the corner and get into gangbangers or the fights and stuff like that. They really didn't have a lot of that going on in the 70s and the 60s. And this is just outrageous now what's going on. They had one out in Greenwood Park where they had organized. I mean, all these kids organized thing called some type of guerrilla family thing. I mean, and it's aiming at the youth. I mean, final 8-year-old rate wearing colors and gang signs. You know, it's just outrageous.
James, Dr. Wilson, I mean, could you hear James's thoughts?
No, I'm afraid I could not hear.
Well, I think what James was talking about was the absolute frustration going on now in inner city neighborhoods because of the rise of gangs, and how he was just talking about how groups in our major park in Baltimore came in and we having guerrilla family kind of recruiting young people, and how that wasn't going on so much back in the late 60s and early 70s. And I guess he's talking about what you're writing about, which is the kind of absolute disintegration going on inside of inner cities. Even more than was in the 60s or 70s.
Yeah, gangs breed in areas that are deteriorating. You don't find gangs flourishing in areas that are stable and strong. Areas where the major institutions are strong and viable. And the inner city is a lot weaker now. You see, in previous years, and I wrote about this in my book, When Work Disappears.
Yes, you did.
People were poor, but they were working. You see, now we have a lot of people who are poor and jobless. And a neighborhood in which people are poor and jobless is a much more dangerous neighborhood than one where people are poor and working. And so we've gone from the working poor to the jobless poor. And when you have that situation, it's a breeding ground for gangs, gang formation.
Let's try having another caller, 410-319-8888. Michael in Baltimore, you're on the air.
When I grew up, Baltimore. Been in Baltimore all my life. I'm 57. And during the 60s and early 70s, it was like a transformation from a progressive black neighborhood to a, you know, to almost nothing. You know, of course, we lost a lot of employment. You know, like General Motors, Bethlehem Steel, some of the chemical companies, Western Electric. But we always had a recreation in parks for the kids to go to all summer long. In fact, these jobs, these community centers would employ people from the neighborhood.
Right.
People had pride in the neighborhood. No longer there anymore. There's nothing for kids to do but get join a gang or hang out on the corners. Of course, we don't want that. We don't even have Little League. You know, football, baseball. We did have that for a while, but I don't see it. I know there is some Little League, but kids aren't interested. Maybe our educational programs have to change to adapt to the children, not adapt to economics, but adapt to the children so that they can be interested in what they do, from the worst student to the best student.
Thank you for your thoughts. And could you hear that one, Dr. Wilson?
Yes, I agree with everything that gentleman was saying. And again, one of the important points to say about the Harlem Children's Zone is that it provides the resources that that kids need a lot of these resources that were quite prevalent in these communities years ago.
And I, this might be a perfect time, the last two callers that came in before we go to our next caller, William Julius Wilson, to talk about the connections. People are making connections here from their own lives about how different it was from in the late 60s and early 70s, where you see the beginning of the breakdown taking place. And to kind of for you to tie in for our listeners how this kind of how the structural issues we face analysis affects the culture we face, create the culture we have today. That tie-in is so little understood, I think.
Yeah, well, let me just say, first of all, you had federal transportation and highway policies that helped shift jobs from the cities to the suburbs. And actually, a lot of manufacturers realized that they're cheaper labor costs in the suburbs. Then you had mortgage interest tax exemptions and mortgage interest tax exemptions for developers and mortgages for veterans that jointly facilitated the out-migration of working and middle-class families from the inner-city neighborhoods to other neighborhoods. And then you had, of course, the Civil Rights Revolution, increasing the opportunity for trained and educated blacks who were able to leave these neighborhoods. All of that happening that facilitated the exodus of industry and families, that was happening at the same time there was a succession of migration from the South to the North. The Great Migration from the South to the North ended around 1970. So you don't have any new migrants flowing in like you do in a Mexican community or the Latino community. You didn't have any new migrants flowing in after 1970, and you had a higher income groups leaving these areas and industries leaving these areas, leaving behind a higher percentage of people who are poor and jobless. To repeat, from densely packed areas of recently arrived migrants from the South to neighborhoods that are gradually abandoned by the working and middle classes.
And do you think those were larger factors than the question of the deindustrialization of...
Well, those factors only relate to the change of neighborhoods that a lot of your callers seem to be describing.
Right, right.
Right. Deindustrialization certainly contributes to the joblessness in the area, in these inner city areas. But I was trying to explain this incredible transformation in inner city neighborhoods from vibrant, densely packed areas where people were poor but working to areas that have been abandoned, and you have vacant lots and abandoned buildings and extremely high levels of joblessness.
And your book also tackles how globalization has really affected poor African-American communities more than any other in America, just about.
Well, what I think that globalization has shifted a lot of jobs that African-Americans, especially black males, depended on. And a lot of these jobs now are in cheaper labor areas overseas. And that's why I said that black workers in this country are competing not only with other workers, poor black workers competing with other workers in this country, but with low-skilled labor around the world.
Dr. William Julius Wilson, it's been an honor and pleasure to talk to you once again. As always, wish we had you for a whole hour. Well, at least we had you for half an hour. I hope we can talk to you again sometime soon.
Thank you. My pleasure, sir.
Lovely to have you with us.
All right. Thank you.
Dr. William Julius Wilson has been our guest. The book, More Than Just Race, Being Black and Poor in the Inner City, is the book. During the Fun Drive Week, we'll try to help you figure out how to get that book into your hands. And that's coming up next week, by the way, so get ready and support your public radio station here at WEAA. We're going to take a very short break. Those of you who are calling in might want to stay on the line just to talk with our next guest coming up in the next half an hour of our show, Felicia Pride, author of the message 100 Life Lessons from Hip-Hop's Greatest Songs. She's the book columnist for TheRoot.com. She'll be joining us here in the studio for the next half an hour. And I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. Over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. For more information, go to MECU.com. We'll be right back with Felicia Pride. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I'm going to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We are joined in studio now by Felicia Pride, author of the message 101 Life Lessons from Hip Hop's Greatest Songs. She's founder of Blacklist, an organization dedicated to uplifting communities with the power of words. The organization arranges workshops, seminars, lectures, and programs for schools and universities. She's an author and is now book columnist for TheRoot.com had this interesting question that she asked a number of black authors about what they would do if they ruled the world, or ruled America at any rate. And Felicia Pride, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
The number here is 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. So what was the exact question you asked them?
If you ruled the literary world.
The literary world.
Yes.
I just kind of expanded it to the world. So tell me how that came about.
I was just sort of thinking about all the changes within book publishing lately because of the recession and the advances in technology, and wondering, as an author myself, if I were more in control of things, what would I want to change? And so I thought about reaching out to fellow authors to see what their opinions were on the same question. What would they change?
And some of the people, there were some really interesting responses. You had an response from a man who's been a guest on the show several times, William Jelani Cobb.
Yes.
Who teaches at
Spelman
College in Atlanta. And a really interesting thinker, very kind of new and original thinker. And he talks about how he would make books matter again, that he wants books to be part of the culture in a way they aren't anymore. About how 30 years ago, turning TV on, you'd see the great authors like Norman Mailer and James Baldwin on talk shows taking on the world, and it was a noble profession, and it's lost, he feels.
I would agree with that, too, in terms of the sort of prominence of authors in our country, in our nation, and then the prominence of books and sort of the respect of books. I think there was a sort of wow when you said that you were an author or you're a writer or you're a novelist. And now it may be also because so many more people now are authors and writers that there may not be that same sort of wow factor. But I do agree with him on wanting to raise the profile of writers and authors.
Some of the other folks who answered this question talked about the fact that so many books being, if the sense was, there's so many books coming out now, there's so many people writing books, that they've been devalued, that even the notion of what it takes to become a writer has been lost.
I definitely agree with that. I think part of that has to do with advances in technology, because now anyone can publish a book, right? You can go to Amazon or they're publishing Book Surge or something like that and upload a manuscript and they send you books. So I do think that there's a lot lost in the process of sometimes, I can't say that all the authors are not necessarily working on craft and, you know, laboring over their manuscript, but there is something lost in the process sometimes when, because of the advances in technology.
So, but you, as a young woman who's a writer and involved in the internet with Blacklist and with The Root and all the other things you're writing, some people look at the internet as a place that has been kind of the root of the problem, no pun intended, that you know.
Possibly. I mean, I think you can look at it twofold. You can look at it as a place where anyone can have a voice. Anyone can say anything, which could be a good thing because it increases access. But then you have the other point of view where, you know, when you think about the people talking about the future of journalism, where now bloggers are sort of taking over, you don't necessarily have those journalists who, you know, studied and went to school or did what they had to do to learn the craft of journalism. maybe you don't have those certain bloggers doing that same process. And that's the same thing with becoming an author. Are we working on our manuscripts? Are we going through the editing process? Are we doing all the things that happens within traditional publishing, even with this new technology that we have?
So if you looked at the advice that the authors who came to you in this, and what would you walk away with? I mean, I think that there's some really interesting things. I think Martha Southgate, whose works I have not read really. I've heard the name, but I've never read her works. She had a really interesting idea. She said she would end MFA programs in writing and focus on literature and reading.
Yes. I don't know about if I would end MFA programs in writing, but I do agree with her opinion on reading and becoming more critical readers, and how becoming more critical readers adds to your ability to write well. I definitely agree with that. I think that maybe what she could be possibly also saying is that some of these writing programs, there's so much concentration on the craft of it that we forget about the sort of partner of writing, which is reading.
So, talk about, I mean, your focus for your own life on writing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't necessarily think I was going to become a writer. I can say that. I went to Towson and went for a marketing degree. I thought I was going to be in business, was bored.
What happened?
Bored.
Bored, just capital B.
Bored, so bored that I started writing. I started writing these sort of rhythmic things, which I wouldn't call poetry, but these rhythmic things. And then I started interning for a newspaper in New York. That's where I was living at the time. And when I saw my byline for the first time, that's what got me.
And what was your first byline?
It was a review of a Mary J. Blige album. So I started writing about music. But then when I decided, oh, wow, maybe I should really pursue this seriously, that's when I went back to school, went to Emerson, and was actually in the writing program, the writing literature and publishing program. But my concentration was book publishing because I actually wanted to work in the industry. And that's what I did when I graduated. I worked in book publishing and still was not one who said I was a writer. I wrote, but I never said I'm a writer. But then slowly, surely made the transition into writer and still do other things. But I try to say that when people ask me what I do say writer first, finally.
On your title is writer. Yes. Writer comes first.
Yes.
So talk a bit about, before we come back to your list, because I really am enthralled by some of these people and how they responded to your questions. Abiola Abrams and some others said some interesting things to you I want to reflect on. But 100 Life Lessons from Hip Hop's Greatest Songs.
Yes.
It's for a lot of older people and the media, it remains a vilified genre.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a war within hip hop itself over who.
Yes,
we are.
Definitely. And I get that a lot when people see the book. If they pick it up originally, they may put it back down because just the word hip hop turns them off. But that was sort of one of my goals in writing the book, was to show that there is power in the music. There is power in the words of many of these young people. But I make it a point to say that, you know, not all of it I found meaning in it. Not all of it has a lot of substance. Not all of it is healthy. And I think that there is a large part of the hip hop generation are those who identify with hip hop who say that. I think that we sort of overshadow or media overshadows our voices in that, and our criticisms, that we do have criticism of hip hop, but we also do feel like there's power in it. And so that was what I wanted to show, was the sort of life lessons and wisdoms that I was able to get from specific hip hop songs.
So when Christopher Chambers writes in response to your
Yes. Yeah, I know how Christian he's yes.
Let me read what he said, we can talk about it. And so our listeners think at 410-319-8888, as we talk about with Felicia Pride here on the air for the next half an hour. He writes, all book publishing houses shall immediately be divested from conglomerate parent corporations. Interesting. Which, when you get down to it, is the real problem. Then all book deals with ex-porn stars, rappers, felons, video rump shakers, mega preachers, unless the book is theology rather than love and money, be canceled and advances forfeited. That they start with that.
Yes.
I like that.
Chris has always been very very outspoken in his opinions about the publishing industry, and that's why I wanted him as part of the, as one of the voices in here, because I wanted his perspective in there. I don't always agree with what he has to say, but he always has a strong perspective, and he also is sort of one of those who is trying to highlight works by Black authors that he feels should get more attention. And so I respect that. Do I think that all rappers shouldn't write books? No. Do I think, do I agree with his list? Not necessarily, but I think he has a strong perspective, and that's why I wanted to include him.
Talking about what Chris Chambers wrote here, Christopher Chambers wrote, that I kind of really kind of found interesting was that what he's saying to me here is that when you have all these books coming out, mm-hmm. almost ad nauseum, ex-porn stars, rappers, felons, video rump shakers, mega preachers who preach about make love and money as opposed to theology and religion. What he's saying to us is that we're being flooded with crap in our bookstores and everywhere we see, and the kind of real substance, as William Jelani Cobb was saying to you, was that we've lost the substance of what it means to be a great writer and encouraging people to read the great stuff and having just kind of that stuff come through instead of all waiting through all the pile of stuff we can't mention on the air.
I definitely agree with that. And I think that part of that has to do with the publishing industry having this still stuck on that blockbuster and the celebrity big book. They have this, they put so much time, energy, and money into these big celebrity books that a lot of the books that are of substance, like you said, that Dr. Cobb is talking about, they get lost in the shuffle. And so that's why we need more outlets to talk about those books that are getting lost in the shuffle, because a lot of the media attention goes to the celebrities and the reality stars. And that shows that's part of our American culture, is that we have this sort of fascination with these types of characters. And so when you have these quieter books, or you have these books that, are by that MFA student who labored on it, that's not necessarily what's sexy. And I think that's a problem within the publishing industry, but it's a problem within the publishing industry that's very much reflected by American culture.
Felicia Pride is joining us here. She is author of The Message, 100 Life Lessons from Hip Hop's Greatest Songs, founder of Backlist, and book columnist now for TheRoot.com. We're talking about her question to a number of great African-American writers. Supposing you ran the literary world, what would you do? And what would you do? And what are you reading now? 410-319-8888. Let's talk about that on the air. 410-319-8888 as we talk with Felicia Pride. And there's another, see if I can find this one piece. Here we go. Let me read this one. I'll say the name after I read it, so you won't know who's coming, but you'll know as soon as I say it. Writers such as Paul Beattie, Touré, and Junot Diaz would be pushed in high school classrooms like crack is on the block. It's high time we stop forcing dead white guys on kids who can't identify with them and introduce teens to great stories they can get into. Also, this is part I like. Also, I'd bubble wrap every last one of the hyper-sexualized urban fiction covers in my local bookstore so moms like me wouldn't be so damn embarrassed to take our kids to the African-American quote-unquote literature section. Oh, and 14-year-olds wouldn't read Zane like ever. So, and that was Deneen Milner.
Yes.
So let's take it backwards. I mean, the whole world of new urban fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's taken that on front on, and that's a dangerous thing to take on because it's become such a popular medium.
Right. And what's interesting is that her husband, Nick Childs, took it on in the New York Times with a piece a few years back called Their Eyes Were Reading Smut.
Yes. Yes.
So right, they definitely have shared views somewhat on that topic. I think
What do you think?
With urban fiction, I go back and forth. Part of me I think one of the big problems with it is that a lot of young people are reading it, and it's not written for young people. It's not traditional YA. So what we have is our young people who want to read up, but in their minds, what they're doing is reading what books they can quote unquote relate to, which tells me that they're feeling like there's a void out there in the marketplace, that they feel like they're not being addressed. So that's a whole community that needs to be addressed, but in a way that is on their level and appropriate for them. Urban fiction kind of moved in and said, hey, you can recognize certain characters from your neighborhood possibly, but it's not written for young adults. So I definitely see Deneen's problem with that. I'm not one of those who say, no urban fiction in the bookstores. I don't necessarily feel that way. I like a good story. But some of the urban fiction that I've read, it's not at that level. What I would love to see is some smart, quote unquote, urban fiction, which, again, I don't even know how I feel about that title, urban fiction. But I would love to see some smart street fiction that's written well. That's my thing. If you have a story to tell, write it well. I think one of the problems is a lot of publishers started throwing a lot of money at people who, quote unquote, claim they were street lit authors,
right,
instead of really thinking about this could be a genre that could really, really attract a certain demographic. And why don't we try to do the same thing that we do with other books and ensure that it's written well and ensure that there's some substance behind it. You can talk about what's going on in the block and the neighborhood, but still try to put some substance behind it. But again, I'm not one of those who wants to lump it all together saying it's all bad, it's all this. But I personally, as an author, don't want literature to become, or books to become, a cash cow to people. You know, they see dollar signs and like, oh, I can get a book deal. I'll just write a story about, you know, coming out of jail. Well, no, people spend a lot of time to sort of become good writers. That's not that, that I don't like.
So. Join us here. Felicia Pride is with us, 410-319-8888. Are you reading what people are calling urban fiction? Is that what you like? Join us with your thoughts. I mean, because is there a contradiction maybe what you're saying when we talk about, now I love Junot Diaz, incredible mm-hmm. writer.
He'll be at City Lit this weekend.
I think he's an amazing writer.
Mm-hmm.
So is Paul Beattie. Touré, I have not read, so I can't.
I really like Touré's books. Very, very imaginative, very different, but they're very good.
So if you take what Deneen says, let's take how we learn how to read, how to write by what we read,
mm-hmm.
and we only give our children in schools books that relate to who they are, as opposed to quote unquote dead white guys or dead anybody, just guys mm-hmm. or women, are we doing our kids a disservice? Because let's say we have a white suburban kid in any place, or a white urban kid in any place. Well, does that mean they shouldn't read Junot Diaz? They shouldn't read James Baldwin from the past? Does that mean that black kids should not read William Shakespeare or Norman Mailer? I mean,
I don't think that's necessarily what she's saying, that we should just push these writers. What I think what she's saying, I don't want to speak for her, but what my opinion is on it.
I wouldn't expect you to.
And especially because I do work with young people in the libraries here in mm-hmm. Baltimore City, trying to get them to read, and it can be a struggle, is that some of our young people we need to meet them where they are at times so that we can take them someplace else. So maybe we do bring them a book that they can see themselves in so that we sort of whet their appetite for reading. And then we take them into the direction of a James Baldwin or whoever it may be. We open it, we expand their horizons. But for many young people who are in schools and are turned off by reading because they don't see themselves in it, we want to be able to get them back into it, say, hey, here's a book that you might enjoy. And once they start to get engaged in the reading process because they have something that actually engages them, then we start to expand their horizons and expose them to different type of literature. I think with some of our young people, we definitely need to meet them where they are.
Join us here, 403. Oh, got some calls coming in. Let's try to get them before the end of the hour. 410-319-8888 as we talk with Felicia Pride, author, columnist, book columnist for TheRoot.com. As we go into the first callers coming in, tell me what you're reading now. What has you at the moment?
Oh, I'm reading The Other Side of Paradise by Stacy Ann Chin,
uh-huh.
who's a poet. And it is great. Like, it's one of those books and where, you know, you're it's so good that you can't wait to start reading it again. So that's how I feel about the book so far. It's really good. It's her memoir and actually came out today. Oh, yesterday, on Tuesday, April 14th.
And what did you read just before that?
Just before that, I read Hold Love Strong by Matthew Goodman, which also came out yesterday. And I think he is a BNN Discover New Writer, so he's a new writer on the scene.
I've not read him either.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you turn me on to two new people here. 410-3, that's what you're supposed to do. 410-319-8888. Felicia Pride is in the studio, and Sarah in Harford County, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I just perchance happens to be listening and tuned into the show. And I think that the thing that she was bringing about urban literature,
mm-hmm.
Now I am a white woman, I'm 29 years old, but I have read some of the Triple Crown books. I can't remember her name. You know what I'm talking about?
Vicky Stringer?
Wahida Clark.
Wahida Clark, okay.
Yes, I read the book Payback is a Mother. But then I also read, and that book is very, very graphic. Children should not read it. I believe. I wouldn't let my child read it. But I also read a book, a wonderful book, by, I believe the author's name is Omar Tyree,
mm-hmm.
and it was called Sweet St. Louis, and I love that book. I absolutely love that book.
You know,
yes, and Omar Tyree, he sort of credits himself with being like the father of urban fiction, because he was out in the early 90s writing
right.
for a different demographic. He's not like hardcore urban fiction like
right.
your... like Wahida Clark or Vicky Stringer or Shannon Holmes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was actually my point. I read the Wahida Clark book. It was interesting. It was entertaining. But the Sweet St. Louis made me think a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I really very much enjoyed that book. The last book I read was actually Stephen Colbert's, since you guys asked. Stephen Colbert's I'm American, So Can You.
That's a funny book.
Yes, that is a great book.
That's a very funny book.
And the book I'm reading right now is about Lizzie Borden. I don't have the book in front of me, so I don't know who it's written by. And I'm also going to start reading books about menopause. One's called The Pause, and the other one is called 101 Things You Wanted to Know About Menopause.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I just finished reading William Julius Wilson's book for the show we just did with him.
Oh, yes.
It was a brilliant book. And reading Laura Lippman's new book at the moment.
Oh.
That's a woman who's gone from, she's become, I think, one of America's greatest mystery writers.
And I'm just amazed at just how prolific she is.
She's amazing. Amazing writer. Can't wait to have her on talk about this particular book, because this book crosses all these racial lines and talks about Baltimore in some really interesting ways. I'm just loving this book. It's also a good mystery.
I'll have to add it to my list.
Oh, absolutely. 410-319-8888. Ray in Columbia, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to thank Ms. Pride for, you know, her comment about, you know, using our, you know, books that our kids can relate to as a hook to really introduce them to other books that really broaden their horizons.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to thank Ms. Pride for the book she's written. I did just start it, and also want to thank her for the wonderful work she's done with the Saturday Academy kids of 100 Black Men of Maryland that she's had a couple of sessions with, and really her style and her approach really gets kids interested where they do broaden their horizons, which is true to her comment.
Thank you.
And I'm the president of 100 Black Men, so I want to thank you for all you've done.
Thank you so much.
Ray, thank you for calling in. We all need fan clubs. That's good. 410-319-8888. Nancy, in your car, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
This is such an interesting conversation today. I'm in a book club, and it's a bunch of women. We're all in our late 30s, early 40s, and the books that we have chosen to read, there was a lot of back and forth on email, several email arguments, because several of the women in our club thought that the books that we were choosing were too highbrow, mm-hmm. and they wanted us to kind of dummy down the selection. We had books like Go Tell It on a Mountain, mm-hmm. and we had Emperor of Ocean Park, mm-hmm. and, you know, just books that were not the usual Cat in the Hat kinds of books. That's what we kind of started calling some of the urban fiction. Can we get a word that's more than, you know, three letters, or can we get a three-syllable word in the whole book? So, you know, it's interesting, you know, just some of the things that's coming out that, you know, we often have to go back in time and read some of the good old classics in order to get, you know, in order to be challenged, literally.
I think that that's really a very strong point.
I would definitely agree.
I mean, Go Tell the Mountain and Baldwin's work, especially that the early Baldwin, the first half of his writing, was some of the most powerful writing ever in American literature.
Definitely. I think that, and that's, and that goes back to my point of, and also Martha Southgate's point about being critical readers. And sometimes when we read things in different places in our lives, we don't see it all. And then when you read as a reader versus read as a writer, you don't see it all as well. So I definitely agree with her comment about going back to,
because sometimes I think what Nancy's talking about is people read to be titillated as opposed to chewing on the words.
That's very true.
Chewing on the book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for me, maybe I'm just old fashioned. I like books that I can chew on, that kind of do something to me as I'm going through them, that make me think as I'm going through it.
Right. But I think also that we shouldn't dismiss the idea of reading as an escapism or as entertainment
it,
for some
all,
people.
It is escaping.
Yeah, definitely. Or the different types of escapism that we can have. Some people fall in love with romance novels because that, you know, it takes them to another place.
Do you have a favorite romance novel?
I don't read a lot of romance.
I don't either. But just curious. Maybe you did. Just checking. So, in your list of authors, Aviola Abrams said that she's thinking in her world, literary world, parents would quote Baldwin, Hansberry, Angelou, Morrison on a daily basis to their children. Artists would be supported emotionally by the communities and regarded as valuable as lawyers and bankers. Amen to that. Hip hop would be a non-commodified art that would have an even stronger literary presence. So, what would we do tomorrow? Same thing we should try every day. Try to take over the world.
Yes, I think I think her point was the fact that, and that's one of the issues with some of our young people not reading. You know, we'll have adults always say, you know, young people aren't reading, but how many of our adults are reading? And how many our young people are seeing the adults reading? So I think that kind of speaks to Aviola's point about being able to quote literature and be familiar with literature.
Felicia Pryor, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I hope people will not be a stranger.
I definitely will not.
Columnist at TheRoot.com, founder of Backlist, author of 100 Life Lessons from Hip Hop's Greatest Songs. Taking a very short break. We'll be back in the next hour with Woody Curry for a fascinating conversation on Baltimore City addiction and many, many other things. Reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This April, Urbanite shows its colors with a green issue, offering a comprehensive guide to eco-friendly living and taking a close look at the area's green-collar economy. You can pick it up at over 800 locations or go online at urbaniteBaltimore.com. Stay with us for Woody Curry. We'll be right back.